This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled weekend. Are you making plans? Or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for an evening of dance, activities celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King's holiday, conversation with a civil rights pioneer, or a good read about a local jazz musician, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. I'm your host, Diane Mack. Had he lived, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would be 84 years old today. As the country prepares to commemorate his life and legacy with various activities on the national holiday on Monday, two prominent leaders in African-American thought will be in town picking up on what was Dr. King's final struggle, the Poor People's Campaign. Princeton University professor emeritus and author, Dr. Cornel West, and public radio TV broadcaster and author, Tavis Smiley, will discuss the eradication of poverty in America in the Poverty Manifesto lecture series presented by Dillard University in conjunction with the High Quality Speakers Bureau. You'll hear first from Dr. Cornel West, then Tavis Smiley.
Beautiful thing to be there with Brother Tavis to talk about King, to be a small part of the legacy of Martin King, connected to the legacy of black people struggling for freedom, but connected to the best of the human spirit, concerned about suffering and trying to alleviate the suffering in the name of justice and fairness.
To do it for the first time together in New Orleans, a very special city to both of us for so many reasons. It's going to be a great day at Dillard.
Smiley and West have been crisscrossing the country, visiting college campuses on their tour on poverty, a mission to eradicate poverty in America by raising awareness as they examine the state of the poor in the digital age. They are the co-authors of The Rich and the Rest of Us, a poverty manifesto, which will be the backdrop for their lecture as they identify the new poor.
The faces are all colors, the precious black faces, precious white faces, precious yellow, precious red, precious brown faces, primarily women and children, but of course there's many brothers of all colors, and we've got a middle class that's slipping into poverty. We got poor people wrestling with the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex. We got poor people going to disgraceful school systems, living in indecent housing. That's where I think Martin King would want the focus to be. The focus is not just on those piercing the glass ceiling. It's also about those stuck in the basement of the house.
We spent the night on the streets in the nation's capital with homeless persons and spent some time with a couple of people, young folk who were students who had dropped out of college, couldn't afford to continue in school, couldn't find work. We saw military vets. Something is really wrong when a nation allows those who have put life on the line to protect the rights of all the rest of us, and they come back and they can't get work. Then we saw people who had worked at jobs for 20, 30 years, who'd been laid off and had lost their homes and lost their 401k, had lost their savings. The new poor in America are the former middle class, and we saw that everywhere we went. We went from Indian reservations in Wisconsin to coal miners down in West Virginia to military vets in Ohio, you know, the barrio, the ghetto. We've been all across this country now on these tours, and so what we saw on this tour is not going to be solved by any slight uptick in the economy or a downtick in unemployment. We have a real crisis here that's only going to be addressed by our leaders developing and creating a plan that we can take seriously to reduce and eradicate poverty, not just trying to put Band-Aids, but we find ourselves, you know, on cliffs and ceilings.
Smiley and West are hoping to inform, engage, and inspire audiences to effect change by pushing for a presidential public policy address and a White House conference on reducing and eradicating poverty. Tavis Smiley and Dr. Cornel West will speak in Lawless Memorial Chapel at Dillard University Monday, January 21st, 7 p.m. There will be an audience Q&A and a signing of their book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. The event is free and open to the public. As most people know, the 1960s were a very tumultuous time in America. Standing in the civil rights movement was a six-year-old girl who integrated the New Orleans school system and helped dissolve segregation across the South. Ruby Bridges shares her story with WWNO's Sharon Litwin.
On a cool day in November 1960, one tiny young African-American child entered an all-white school in New Orleans' Ninth Ward, accompanied by stern-looking armed federal marshals. Newspapers across the country covered the story, accompanied by pictures of the howling, ugly mobs outside the William Franz Elementary School. I was reminded of that event a couple of weeks ago when I talked with that now-grown woman about a children's book fair she was involved with in New Orleans. I wanted to know how Ruby Bridges lived through that time.
It really was a hard position to be in at 6 years old. I think what helped me to survive was the fact that I was not aware of what was really going on. My parents never really explained to me what was happening. And living here in New Orleans and being accustomed to Mardi Gras, all of the people that I saw out in front of the school chanting and waving their hands looked exactly like Mardi Gras to me. So that thought stayed with me for quite a while before I finally realized that it wasn't Mardi Gras, that the crowd was there for me, and that it was all about the color of my skin.
She found that out because the only teacher who stayed to teach her in what was a completely empty classroom protested their isolation from the few other students. For there were, in fact, a few white children who had not boycotted the school, but they were hidden from Ruby, even though she could hear them in other classrooms. The teacher won the argument, and Ruby was allowed to meet them.
But that's the day that I really found out that it was about me and the color of my skin, because this little boy said, "I can't play with you. You know, I can't play with you. My mom said not to." And I realized at that point that it was about me. That was really, really hard because for the most part, six-year-old kids, it doesn't matter to them what their friends look like. The most important thing is that they have friends. And I think he and I were no different. It was just the adults involved in that situation that kept us separated and apart. So the worst part for me was the loneliness and not really understanding what was going on and why me? What was the matter with me?
Now, 52 years later, when so many things about our schools have changed and so many things about them have not, Ruby and I talked about the role of parents.
Both of my parents were sharecroppers, and so education was really a luxury for them. My mother had probably an eighth grade education and my father sixth grade. And so when the knock came at the door back in 1960, asking them if they would be willing to send their six-year-old to one of the first integrated schools in New Orleans, you know, she jumped at the opportunity to do that. My father was a little bit against it. My father fought in the Korean War, and he said even on the battlefield, you know, if you were on the front line and fighting next to a white soldier, if you lived at the end of the day, you had to go back to different barracks. You couldn't eat in the same mess hall. And so he felt like if that didn't change things, then sending me to this white school wouldn't change things.
But it did change things, at the very least for Ruby. How could it not?
What started me on my quest to make some difference and some change in the world because of my experience was the fact that even though that mob was outside of the school every day, there was a white woman there to greet me every day. She came from Boston to teach me when other teachers actually quit their jobs and didn't want to teach black children. And so I honestly believe that the lesson I took away at 6 years old in that empty school building was the same lesson that Dr. King tried to teach all of us. And that is that you cannot look at a person and judge them, that you have to allow yourself an opportunity to get to know them. That's what I did with Mrs. Henry. I think she allowed herself an opportunity to get to know me. That lesson stuck with me and I believe shaped me into who I am today. And I just thought in my mind that for the most part, adults just don't quite get that.
And that's why Ruby Bridges is still working with children in schools. For WWNO and NolaV.com, I'm Sharon Litwin.
More info about Ruby Bridges can be found online at rubybridges.com. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm Diane Mack.
I know that my audiences, when they see my work, they really do have an experience.
She's Jessica Lange, choreographer and artistic director of Jessica Lange Dance. New Orleans is one of the first cities in the country to host her newly formed contemporary ballet company, presented by the New Orleans Ballet Association and the Noka Institute. The troupe is garnering acclaim for its imaginative stage presentation. We caught up with Lang by phone and found she's quite excited to bring her newly formed company of 9 dancers to the Crescent City.
The company is diverse dancers that are equally trained in ballet and modern. I do most of my work with ballet companies, so it is a classical company in the sense that everyone has an extensive background in classical technique, but I would say they are equally versed in modern dance. And so that's why I call the company dance and not ballet, because it just is that. It's kind of all-encompassing. You will see point work, but you will also see grounded modern work with innovative sets and incorporating visual components to the work. And I think it's just really something that kind of engages all kinds of audiences. So we're lucky that a lot of people are interested in what we're doing.
Lange is a former Twyla Tharp dancer and a graduate of the Juilliard School. She has created more than 75 works for major companies, including American Ballet Theatre and the Joffrey Ballet. Her company of acclaimed dancers will present a program of 6 unique works.
We are opening with a piece called Lines Cubed, which is inspired by Piet Mondrian, the Dutch painter who works with black lines against the white canvas and then the color blocks of primary colors blue, red, and yellow. And so that piece is all-encompassing of color and emotion. And the second piece on the program is called Mendelssohn Incomplete, and it's the Mendelssohn Piano Trio in D. And we finish that act with a piece called Among the Stars with music by Sakamoto, and that is a duet for Clifton Brown and Laura Mead, and that will be on point.
Other works include a film called White, with special effects and no dancers on stage. And there is a fluid finale called Ink, with a score by Polish composer Jakub Czupinski, a work inspired by visual artist Shinichi Maruyama.
I was really inspired by his artwork called Kusho. He uses Japanese ink, and he throws it in the air and captures it on video, ink and water splashing in space. So I used the video projections and made a dance in front of the video.
Lange, who grew up in Pennsylvania, says she knew early on that dance was her calling.
I really knew around the age of 14, 15, I had met Joe Lantieri, whom many young dancers today know who he is because he runs this really successful competition called New York City Dance Alliance. He just casually said to me, you know, you're really talented. You should come take my class in New York. That was it. I connected. My parents, they made it possible to drive me every day 2 hours from Philadelphia to take Joe's class.
That dedication certainly paid off. You can be the judge, as Jessica Lange Dance makes its New Orleans debut with performances at Noka's Lupin Hall. Limited tickets are available for the January 18th and 20th performances. More info at nobadance.com. New Orleans band leader and jazz trombonist Edward Kidd Ory gets due recognition in the new book from New Orleans photojournalist and jazz historian John McCusker. Creole Trombone, Kidd Ory, and the Early Years of Jazz. WWNO's Fred Kasten, who produces The Sound of Books, has more.
¶¶ John McCusker grew up on New Orleans' West Bank in Algiers, started taking pictures when he was 7, had his own darkroom at 14. McCusker earned a degree in journalism from Loyola, and in 1986 went to work for the Times-Picayune as a staff photographer. It was, as it turned out, making pictures that put him on the path to jazz.
The real watershed for me in terms of learning about New Orleans jazz happened in 1992. The historian Bill Russell passed away. And one of our photo editors was trying to find a picture of Bill Russell to run in the paper. And we couldn't find one. And he said kind of out loud to everybody and to nobody, you know, one of you guys ought to go find all these old guys and make pictures of them so when they die we at least have one to run in the paper. And that launched me on a year-long project where I went and tracked down all of the old guys from Louis Armstrong's generation who were still around and made portraits of them and did their oral histories, got their stories and told their stories. And that developed into a three-part series we did at the Times-Picayune called Jazz Men, The End of the Beginning.
Which got John McCusker really listening to early New Orleans jazz for the first time in his life. McCusker got so enamored of the music and the musicians that he created and started operating a tour of jazz landmarks and locations, the Cradle of Jazz Tour.
And it was actually that tour that led me to the Kid Ory book. I was giving the tour one day, and we got to Kid Ory's house on Jackson Avenue, and you know, I gave the basic spiel about Kid Ory, was that he was a sideman on the records of Louis Armstrong, King Oliver, and Jelly Roll Morton, and that he'd been a major figure in the revival movement. And there was a trombonist from Fresno, California named Dave Ruffner on the tour, and he said, well, look, I really enjoyed the tour, but I think you really missed the boat on Kid Ory. You know, he was so much more than that. He was a link between the earliest pioneers like Buddy Bolden and the ultimate jazz man, Louis Armstrong. And it was in his band that the first generation of jazz stars emerged.
That didn't sit so well with John McCusker.
You know, I was kind of peeved about this, you know. I was like, who is this guy from Fresno, California going to tell me about jazz? But I went to the to Dr. Bruce Boyd Rayburn at the Tulane Jazz Archive, and he sided with that guy and said, yeah, well, he's right. Ory's a major overlooked figure. There's a controversy about his birthday. Eventually, Rayburn hooked me into doing a book on him.
Kid Ory was born in 1886 on the Woodland Plantation in La Place.
His father is white. He's from the plantation, at one time slave-owning Ory family of St. John the Baptist Parish. His mother was a Creole of color named Octave Davazin. They were not allowed to be married because of the laws at the time, but they lived together for 30 years and raised 7 children together. He worked on the sugarcane plantation, and he hated it, just hated it. And, you know, this is a time when a lot of people are starting to leave the plantations and go to the city. So the call of the city was very much there for him. He gets to the city by 1905, and that's when he really first encounters Buddy Bolden. And Bolden was clearly Ory's biggest influence early on. He said what Bolden was doing was he was playing the blues for dancing, and that was a real innovation. So Ory glommed onto that, and you know, it's clear that he learned many of his musical ideas from listening to Buddy Bolden's band.
Kid Ory moved to New Orleans full-time in 1910 and brought his band from La Place with him. They quickly established themselves as one of the hottest bands in town, and for most of a decade remained at the top of the dance band scene in the city, eventually employing some of the greatest stars of early jazz, including King Oliver and Louis Armstrong.
When I got interested in this music, there really wasn't any biography that you could go to that really told the New Orleans part of the tale. You know, even the books that have been praised about Louis Armstrong, they kind of say, oh, well, this stuff happened in New Orleans, and then there's Chicago, and then there's New York. And what I really wanted to get to was what happened in New Orleans. That's where the magic happened. So who were the guys that were around? And, you know, Ory turns out to be an oracle of those times. He witnessed everything. He knew everybody from Bolden to Armstrong to King Oliver to Jelly Roll Morton. He saw it all. So by telling Ory's story, I was able to step back as well and look at the larger canvas and also tell the arc and the emergence of jazz as a music.
John McCusker, author of the highly recommended new biography and jazz history, Creole Trombone, Kid Ory and the Early Years of Jazz. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Caston.
we have something extra for you in our Lanyap Corner. Leonard Bernstein's comic operetta, Candide, will be performed January 18th and 20th at Loyola University in Roussel Hall. The January 18th presentation is set for 7:30 p.m., and the January 20th performance will be at 3 p.m. The Loyola Symphony Orchestra will perform the score. More info at montage.loyno.edu. And the Ashe Cultural Arts Center is inviting you to lift your voice with freedom and healing songs from the civil rights movement to the present in celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King's Day. The Community Sing will feature performances by Reverend Louis Desjans, Troy Henry, Deacon John, and others. The event is free and open to the public. January 20th from 5 to 8 p.m., 1712 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next week at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.